Continue with the gospel according to Luke. We're now in the 15th chapter. Now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to Jesus, and the Pharisees and scribes were grumbling and saying, "This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them." So he told all of them this parable. There was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me." So he divided his property between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had, traveled to a distant country, and there he squandered his property in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens there, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled himself with the pods the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare? And here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still off, his father saw him, was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quickly bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Get the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his elder son was in the field. When he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked what was going on. He replied, 'Your brother has come. Your father has killed a fatted calf because he's got him back safe and sound.' He became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him, but he answered his father, 'Listen, for all these years I've been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you've never given me even a young goat so I may celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed a fatted calf for him.' The father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me. All that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found.' In our hearing, our speaking, our living. He was right, the older brother. Over the years, I've considered this passage from so many different angles. It's so powerful and rich in meaning and layers and depth and multiple interpretations. 6 years ago, we had a curriculum for the children and youth that for the whole season that just was based on this one story. It's so good. We are, again, in year C of the cycle, which means we hear mostly Luke's gospel, so the story has come up again. And for some reason, this time around, I really find myself drawn to that older brother. Often maligned, looked upon as a spoil sport, as judgmental, angry, filled with resentment. But he was right. Fuming as he was out in the field, he was right about the damage his brother had done to the family, their reputation, their property. about his disrespecting their father and insulting their culture, their way of life, about throwing all of it away, only to come back and be allowed back in. The older brother is right to ask why his own responsible behavior never seemed to be recognized, much less rewarded. He's right to view his father's welcome of the reprobate son to be scandalous, outrageous, offensive. There's a context, of course, for Jesus telling this tale. There are tensions already between Jesus and the religious authorities. So he's been telling these other stories about a lost coin and a lost sheep. And he's been healing people nobody thought deserved to be healed. And he has been eating with those people. He is disrupting ideas about who is and who is not worthy, who God does and does not welcome. It is an outrageous story, and a key part of it is this estrangement between father and sons, and brother and brother. Many of us know something about estrangement, don't we? It's very real. Family estrangement is sadly real and sadly common. I've been at the bedside more than once at the time of death when someone's fondest wish was that they be reconciled with a family member. Estrangement between parent and grown child or siblings can cause incredible pain, with old wounds and digging in heels, every side convinced of who's right and who has been wronged. Whether it's a minor difference of opinion or a deep wound caused by one person, it can be very hard to see a way forward. One of the shows, the only show I think right now we both watch in our house is The Good Place. Does anybody else watch The Good Place? Oh, it's great stuff. It's not even violent. Yay. It's a very well-written show, and it centers around four people who died and find, I won't give away too much in case you're going to start watching it. They find themselves in what's supposed to be the good place, euphemism for heaven. And over time, we get to learn the backstories of the main characters. One of these is a woman named Tani, who is just always, always, everything has to be perfect and always making the best impression on everybody else. And then we start to hear the story of Tani and her sister, how they were wealthy overachievers in their family, socialites, and how they despise each other. They are driven by a deep-seated resentment. And yes, it is a comedy. There's something of a reconciliation that happens only after they both realize how their parents set them in competition with each other. And once they realize they had a common enemy, their resentment eased. It's not the healthiest way to reconcile, but it worked for them. I want to believe the elder son finally went up to the house and walked through the door and joined the festivities. I like happy endings. I want to believe that the next day, after they shouted at each other a bit, they then sat down and talked for hours and set some boundaries. And that each of them, father and brothers, agreed it was going to take time to really build trust back up. I like to imagine that they got to a place where they were honest enough that they could joke some where the younger brother could tease the older one for being so uptight. And the older one could tease the younger one for still smelling like pigs. And they both could tease their father for just being weird. And then they went and ate the party leftovers. We don't know. It is a brilliant bit of storytelling on Jesus' part that he leaves it open-ended. What would it look like for the older brother to rejoin the party? What has to shift? A number of us over the past few weeks have studied the book, The Anatomy of Peace, Healing the Heart of Conflict. It talks a lot about cultivating a heart that is at peace in all circumstances. Talks about how we tend to get stuck in boxes, and these boxes in our minds affect how we treat others. If we're in a box that says we deserve more than what we've received, we're likely to treat other people as a threat, as having gotten more than their share. If we believe we're better than others, we're likely to respond to others as though they are inferior, and vice versa. The authors focus on the understanding of how people actually change, not generally by shaming and punishing and shunning, which don't seem to work very well. They change when they're invited to by grace. They don't use that theological term, but that's what it is. We help others change when we first change ourselves and when our hearts are at peace toward the other and not at war. Often our hearts are at war and we don't even realize it. I've seen enough family reconciliations that I can say don't ever give up. Sometimes for a while we have to give it a rest and let God work on it. Sometimes if it's an abusive situation, there should be no reconciliation without serious changes in behavior. But don't give up. The older brother's heart was at war with his brother and his father. He was correct about a lot of things, but as long as his heart remained at war, nothing would change and estrangement would prevail. He would remain, as someone said, 100% right and 100% alone. I wondered what I would say to that brother after the father walked away if I had the chance. I think I would begin by telling him, "You are right to be appalled and envious and angry. Your brother behaved horribly, and there's no guarantee he's truly changed. Your father has gone far beyond the bounds of what was expected and accepted and reasonable. You're right. And you have a choice to join the party or not." I would say to him, "Like you, I want things to be fair. I understand the fear that there may not be enough to go around, enough resources, enough forgiveness, enough love. That's so hard. I know it is. Even harder is the lesson in all this, a lesson you want to resist with all your might, but one I urge you to allow to take hold. Grace isn't a byproduct of repentance. It enables it. It makes space for it. It invites it in. You want the lines to be clean and neat, with the deserving on one side, the undeserving on the other, the righteous clearly identifiable, and the sinful marked and separated. But our notions of worthiness and unworthiness seldom hold up well over time. The lines are never as clear as we want them to be. And each time we draw those lines, Jesus comes along and messes them up. So no matter what your sibling does tomorrow, whether he gets up and breaks a sweat helping you in the fields or sleeps in till noon, whether he's like a new person or nothing seems to have changed at all, your peace, your joy, your worth do not need to depend on his behavior. They never have. And if the brother was still listening, I would say, be kind to yourself. Be patient with yourself. Let go of the fear and cultivate joy. The only way to do that is to stop keeping score. It's too heavy a load to bear, and it robs you of joy. Keeping score obscures your vision to the point where you cannot see the one who loves you without condition, who longs to bring you, yes, you, home. You see, prodigal doesn't mean runaway. It means wastefully extravagant. And the holy parent who loves you is just that, pouring out love in wastefully extravagant ways. That can be so hard to accept and harder to receive, but the power of divine love is making its way to you now, running to you even as you are sorely tempted to turn back to the field and bury yourself in your work. Let that love find you, embrace you, hold you, and tell you it's going to be okay. Tell you you are so greatly loved and that there is nothing held back from you, nothing. I can't tell you to get over your pain or release the long-held resentment, but I can remind you, we can remind each other that there's a party. It doesn't make any sense, and you may not be in a party mood, and there are 100 reasons why not to go, and there's a party, and we are already at it. The life of the party isn't your wayward brother. It is grace itself, unmerited, unexpected. It is not our party to control, and we are to come just as we are. Give yourself permission to join the party, to feel the joy that comes from putting down the burden of always needing to be right, always needing to be seen as good, and having it all together. Dear older brother, you are right to be appalled and envious and angry, and you have a choice to join the party or not. You get to compose the ending. And as the poet once wrote, let your God love you. Amen.